Pete's Couch Potatoes across the country, around the world, on the radio and on the internet. I'm Kevin Carr, and you're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies. On today's show, I'm going to be talking about the films Wish, Napoleon, Thanksgiving, Planes, Trains, and Automobiles, and a quick revisit of Maestro. I'm also going to be talking about some news, the Trailer Park, and the Home Cinema Roundup featuring The Bride and the Beast. But first, if you want to get in touch with me, you can email me at fatguys@fatguysatthemovies.com. You can leave me a voicemail at 740-205-6456. That's 740-205-6456. You can find me on the internet at fatguysatthemovies.com or facebook.com/fatguysatthemovies. And if you want to reach out to me on Blue Sky or Mastodon, I'm at Kevin Carr.
Good evening. I'm Ron Burgundy, and this is what's happening in your world tonight.
This last weekend, The Hunger Games, The Ballad of Songbirds and Snakes, got the top spot with $44.6 million, which isn't great. It's a little less than what they were predicting, but it was at least close to what they were predicting. But here's the thing. The other Hunger Games movies, especially the first two, made a lot more money in their opening weekend. This opening weekend is more along the lines of the Divergent series. It wasn't a ripoff of Hunger Games, but it was the next series they wanted to make in terms of those teen dystopian futures. But if they're going to do more movies like this, they are going to have to justify their existence, because I don't think it'll build from here. For a movie like this, you tend to have diminishing returns. And this is, it'll eventually make money because the budget was only about $100 million. And it'll probably leg it out to at least worldwide enough money to break even for the studio or maybe make even some cash. But this is not a great number. More on that in a minute. But then in number two, you had Trolls Band Together, which made about $30 million. And that's not bad for the Trolls movie. It's not anywhere close to the first one, but the second one, because it went to Peacock directly because it was during the pandemic, it's really uncertain to what this franchise can do, because each of the three movies have come out in very different circumstances. But still, $30 million for a relatively cheap movie like this is not bad, but it's going to be probably on Peacock by Christmas? Who knows? And then in third place, you had Thanksgiving, which was originally reported in fourth place. It bumped up to third place with $10.3 million, beat out the Marvels from last week. Again, more on that later. But Thanksgiving, which I'm going to cover this week because I did not have time to watch it last week, that's not bad. It's $10 million. I think the budget for it is like $15 million. So by the time I'm done speaking, it's probably made it back by this point, at least grossed its budget. It's going to get a little bit more. This is going to leg out for a little bit. Horror movies tend to do well because you don't spend much money on them. If you have a very, very expensive $150 million horror movie, that's very hard to make that money up. But if you make a horror movie for $15, $20 million or less, then you're probably sitting pretty. And that is the Blumhouse model. Now, Blumhouse did not do Thanksgiving, but it has been very successful doing other horror movies. Don't let anybody tell you otherwise. Horror has been doing exceptionally well over the last couple years. Now, in fourth place, this is the one that's making the news, is The Marvels, which suffered a catastrophic drop, 78% drop to $10.1 million. They actually bumped it down to fourth place when the actuals came in after the weekend. And that's not good. I mean, The Marvels is not doing well, and there's reasons for it, and I'll talk about that in a minute. And the reason it's such a disaster is for the same reason all these other movies have been disasters this year. The budget was well over $200 million. I mean, I think actual money spent was somewhere in the ballpark of $220 million. You need to make over a half billion dollars just to even come close to breaking even on a project like that. And I know it's a Marvel movie, but there's reasons. Now, first of all, let's talk about two different things. This is not an atypical performance for a movie this year, because there's a political nature of this, because there's a lot of people out there. There are some fanboys out there and some people that hate Brie Larson, so they want to see her fail, so they're attacking her. And there's also this, people love to see something get big and then completely collapse. And so people have been frothing at the mouth, waiting for superhero fatigue, where they want to see something fall. They want to see Marvel fail. And so that plays into their narrative. But this isn't the only movie. There have been multiple movies, like you had Fast 10, you had Indiana Jones and the Dial of Destiny, you had Transformers Rise of the Beasts, you had The Flash, you had even Mission Impossible Dead Reckoning Part 1. All these movies were $250 to $300 million to make. And so they just didn't make their budget back because they needed to make so much money. Maybe the problem isn't superhero fatigue. Maybe the problem is people are spending upwards of $300 million or more to make a movie. Maybe that's the problem. Because the reality is, you can't sustain that. That's going back to the horror stuff with Thanksgiving, what I was saying. Spend less money. Gosh, when they're talking about Hunger Games, Ballad of Songbirds and Snakes was only $100 million. Only $100 million? I'd like to have only $100 million in my pocket. But if that's considered lower budget now, I think the budgets have gotten out of control and they need to rein those in. Now, one more thing with the Marvels. I think here's the reason I think why the Marvels failed. Captain Marvel is not a good comparison to it because Captain Marvel came out between Infinity War and Endgames. It was at when Marvel was at the top of its game and it was a cultural event. The other thing is, it's a team up of three characters, and yeah, you have Captain Marvel, who really was only in Captain Marvel and then the Endgame and Infinity War Avengers movies, and even in Infinity War, she just shows up at the very end. She's not a well-developed or consistent character in the Marvel Universe, but the other thing is the other two characters, Monica Rambeau came from as a side character from WandaVision, and Kamala Khan comes from Ms. Marvel. So those were both Disney Plus series. And you can't expect everybody to follow TV as much as movies. The same thing happened with Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. or the Defenders series on Netflix. I don't think there's a revolt against woke filmmaking. I don't even think this movie was woke filmmaking. I think this movie was just one that they underestimated the amount of interest because they underestimated the crossover potential of lesser-known characters. But don't worry, let's not have a bake sale for Marvel yet. They've got the whole Fantastic Four and X-Men properties to mine. Listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That sound means it's time to roll into the trailer park. The first one is Mr. Monk's Last Case, which is coming to Peacock on December 8th.
I have traumatic symptoms unprecedented in psychiatric history.
He's afraid of heights. It's his second biggest fear after germs.
Actually, it goes germs, needles, birds, then heights.
When COVID hit, I was in bad shape.
Everybody's you.
They're gonna hate it. Here's what happened.
So how does that feel to be working again?
Like riding a bicycle.
Oh, I'm glad to hear that.
I mean, it's terrifying.
This is a reunion of the Monk TV show with Tony Shalhoub. It was on USA for many years. I think it was on 8 or 9 seasons. Great show about a fastidious OCD detective. So he gets his own movie in this one, and it's nice to see him back. And they're showing him having regressed because of COVID, and that works very well into it. Now, if you go back and you watch, you can find an old short they did during COVID with Mr. Monk, which was perfect because he's a germaphobe. This looks like it's a lot of fun. I've always loved Monk. I think Tony Shalhoub's a comedic genius. Very much looking forward to this in a couple weeks. The next one I want to talk about is Mean Girls, which is coming to theaters on January 12th.
What was that?
Oh, Lord, it's the queen bee.
Regina George.
Don't look her in the eye!
You could be really hot if you changed, like, everything.
We as women have to be able to support each other.
Get in, loser.
Welcome, Katie.
You're never going to believe what I found this morning.
Your burn book.
Mom, go make snacks.
For sure, Regina, yeah.
All we've done is make Regina hotter and revive the wet look.
Dance break.
This is the musical adaptation of the movie. It's sort of like when they did Hairspray or The Producers. They adapted it into a Broadway musical, and now they've got the Broadway musical version of Mean Girls. I've never seen Mean Girls, I will admit. I'm curious to see whether all the cultural jokes hold up. I'm curious to see whether this is as popular of a movie as the Broadway play was. It may not. It may just kind of collapse because of toxic ideas in there that don't quite click. Now, I don't know. I've never seen the movie. So we'll see. I'm not dying to see it, but I'm going to end up seeing it, I'm sure. Coming up next on Fat Guys at the Movies, I'm going to be talking about Napoleon and Thanksgiving. Welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's jump into the movie reviews and go to war. We're going to war. And we're going to be talking about Napoleon. I don't know what happened there. I was channeling some wrestler from the 90s. I don't know. Ridley Scott directs this biopic of French dictator and military genius Napoleon Bonaparte. Everyone
around is... What is this costume you have on?
This is my uniform. Everyone so
near. What is your name?
Napoleon.
Has the course of my life just changed?
I am destined for greatness. Everyone around. But those in power will only see me as a sword.
I suggest you take the throne
as a king.
I'm the first to admit when I make a mistake. I simply never do.
Full disclosure here, this was not screened in my local market. I come from Columbus, Ohio. There have been a lot of screenings. Don't worry, I'll have plenty of time in January when everyone forgets about the critics. It's award season right now, so we're getting courted. But it's funny, I got a letter, an email from Sony, and it's like, come to these screenings. Look at all these places. The closest one was Cleveland. Cleveland's 2.5 hours away. I'm not going to drive 2.5 hours to see a 3-hour movie about Napoleon. I'm sure it's a wonderfully made movie. Ridley Scott's stuff looks great. I don't know. Some of his historical epics, he is very hit or miss. Like the Kingdom of Heaven was the one with Orlando Bloom in the Crusades. And I've heard that the director's cut, which is much, much longer than the original theatrical cut, is a much more coherent and well-made movie. It's a longer film, but it's much, much better. And I've been hearing that about Napoleon, that there's a 4-hour cut of this movie. But I'm not going to go see a 4-hour movie. I'm so tired of 3-hour movies. And I know people are going, oh, you need to have a better attention span. It's like, no, there are some movies that are 3 hours or more that I'm like, that justifies it. But there's a lot of them that are not. And like I said, something like Ridley Scott's historical epics, like the last one he did that I remember was the Last Duel, about the rape prosecution going on in like 12th century France or something like that. That was just bloated and long, and it was interesting, but it just, it did wear on you. And you know, Ridley Scott's, I think, showing his age. But this was not screened, so I have to give it a preemptive suck. I have to say that. I mean, they didn't show it to me. I'll eventually see it, but the studio made no effort for me to, so I'm not going to make any effort to promote their film.
It sucks.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. The next movie I want to talk about is Thanksgiving. This came out last week, and we talked about this in the box office segment, so we already know how well it did last weekend. I wanted to see it. I just didn't have time to check it out last week before, because, of course, they didn't screen that either. So I went and saw it this week. I figured Thanksgiving week is the perfect week to see Thanksgiving. I followed Eli Roth's career. I think I've seen most, if not all, of his movies. He hasn't directed a ton, but he loves horror movies. So I'm also a big horror movie fan. And so let's talk about Thanksgiving. A serial killer targets Plymouth, Massachusetts after a Black Friday tragedy.
Thanksgiving is a time for appreciation. It's a time to remember our many blessings, to celebrate with the ones that we love the most, and it's time for all families to be together.
No, 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 no!
Let's see.
This comes from, if you don't know the story, and I talked about this when I played the trailer in the trailer park several months ago, this comes from the movie Grindhouse. When Quentin Tarantino and Robert Rodriguez made the movie Grindhouse, which was a double feature, they got some other directors to direct fake trailers for fake Grindhouse-type movies. A Grindhouse movie is some crappy exploitation film that was played at like midnight movies, and the prints are usually bad, and they got splices and cuts. And I've gone to my fair share of Grindhouse things, and there's some terrible movies, but there's also some great fun you can have at a Grindhouse. Well, Eli Roth directed a fake trailer for Thanksgiving. And it felt more in line with the 70s horror movies. It felt grittier into the 70s, but it still could fit in the slasher, like that run of slashers from like 1981 to 1982, 84. There was this glut of teen slasher movies where it was still had that grittiness of the 70s, and he hadn't gotten to the pop bubblegum neon colors of the mid to late 80s. They did the same thing with Machete. Robert Rodriguez directed a fake trailer called Machete, and then he made a movie out of it. They did that with Hobo with a Shotgun, which was in the Canadian version of Grindhouse, and then they made a movie out of that. This is the latest one. Eli Roth made this Thanksgiving slasher film. Now, it takes place in the modern world. It's contemporary because they got cell phones and iPhones and Instagram and broadcasting and that kind of thing. And that actually is integral to the plot, and I'm okay with that. I really did kind of wanted to see a gritty 70s, early 80s slasher movie, but I understand why he did this movie the way he did. It's so hard to encapsulate something like this because there's problems with this movie. I mean, there's corny dialogue, there's dumb characters, people do stupid things throughout. It's cliche and it's silly and it's corny, but it's supposed to be that way. It's paying homage to grindhouse cheap pulp fiction. And he does a very good job kind of making that his own. And it's funny because Eli Roth, his movie Cabin Fever, I thought was kind of brilliant. Because it was a slasher film. It was a killer in the woods, but it wasn't a person. It was a disease. So I thought that was an interesting spin on it. And Hostel, he did the same thing where he basically made a slasher movie with all the tropes of a slasher film, but it was, you know, this travelogue horror film. And they did like the Green Inferno, which spins off of stuff like Cannibal Holocaust. And I mean, I'm really going into the weeds here when it comes to horror history, but that's Eli Roth loves horror movies the way Quentin Tarantino loves kung fu movies. And I think he really nailed this one, very much as he nailed Cabin Fever, maybe less hostile, but I think he really nailed that feel of the zeitgeist of these movies, if you want to use a snotty term. I'm okay with all of that. I mean, it's full of cliches, but that's kind of the point as a tribute to 80 slasher films. That's what you're going for. So when something dumb happens, you can see it as, oh, this is what they did in these horror movies. It also shows it's made by somebody with great love of the genre. Somebody, which is Eli Roth, who just loves slasher movies and loves horror movies. There's visual references to stuff like Halloween. It opens with a reference to Halloween, which is kind of brilliant. And it has the mass killer. It also has the gore. That's the other thing, is in some of these movies, they really skimp on the gore. But what's funny, it doesn't overdo it, which is surprising because Eli Roth is the guy who did Hostel and everything. But there's also there's an absurdist nature to the violence that happens in this movie. I mean, look, I don't like real violence against real people, but this is just a pulp horror film. Ridiculous stuff happens to people, and you're like, that. There's no way even the biophysics works on some of this stuff, but that's what you got in these old movies. It has all the characters, you know, it has the teen girl and her boyfriend and the dim-witted sheriff who can't figure any of it out. And you got the outcast who's in, trying to kind of edge in on the friends. It has all those elements, and it's done by somebody who knows what he's doing with the genre, and it really works. It's just maybe just a hair too long, but overall, I enjoyed it. I mean, I'm going to say that Thanksgiving totally rocks.
It rocks.
Excellent!
Coming up next on Fat Guys at the Movies, I'm going to be talking about Wish and a revisit of Maestro. Welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's continue on with the movie reviews and talk about Wish. This is the latest Disney animated movie. You got to realize Disney's a huge company. In addition to Star Wars or Lucasfilm and Marvel, they own Disney Animation Studios, the Walt Disney Pictures and Touchstone and all those other ancillary arms, and they own Pixar. It's funny because there's a lot of people, I know this because this is my job, but Pixar and Disney Animation Studios are two different things. And they have different feel to the type of stories they tell. Now, it's interesting because John Lasseter used to work for Pixar, got a job heading Disney Animation Studios. He got Me Too'd. But Disney Animation Studios, they did stuff like Moana and Frozen. Those are probably the two biggest hits they've had. Now, they had a huge flop last year with Strange World, which I understand. It was real high concept, and nobody understood what it was about, and it's not based on anything. And now they've got Wish, and Wish is a bit of a, you know, it swings for the fences, but let's talk about it here. In a kingdom where a sorcerer keeps the people's wishes in a castle, one young woman hopes to free them.
Imagine a place where wishes come true. Where your heart's desire can become a reality. What if I told you that place is within reach? All you have to do is give your wish to me.
Unlike Moana, but a little more like Frozen, it's told as a fairy tale. It's in that fairy tale structure, you know, castles, medieval style, you know, kings and queens and wizards and magic. As opposed to some of these, other movies, like Encanto a couple years ago, that was not like a Disney princess type movie. This one, and she's not a princess in this, the main character played by Ariana DeBose, she's basically a peasant trying to save the people, but it has that medieval feel to it, but it's not like based on Snow White or Sleeping Beauty or Cinderella or something like that. But the ideas behind it are really high concept. They almost feel like a Pixar pitch, where it's like this guy can take people's wishes and it takes away from their personality, and he hides them in the castle and he keeps them so he can dole out basically people's desires to do things. And that feels very out there. That's like an Inside Out or Elemental or Soul or one of these Pixar movies where it's very surreal and almost existential. I really like that, but it's funny because it does have this disconnect to the traditional fairy tale. Now, like, Frozen was very much, even though it wasn't a real fairy tale that people recognized like Snow White, it hit all those beats and it fit into that world. I think that this world is a little bit odd. It doesn't quite work, but you kind of just have to go with it, and you really have a sweet little story. It's beautifully animated, first of all. I mean, it's just gorgeous. The artistry, and the Disney has moved into doing this thing. Instead of doing full CGI, they kind of do this, and they make it look like it's almost like a 3D two-dimensional picture, where it still looks like it has an ink and paint feel to it, but it's done with computers, and the background and the level of detail is amazing. But it's also very funny, and it's very cute. And the other thing is, for me, as a Disney nerd, as an animation nerd, as a film nerd, it's the 100-year anniversary of Disney Animation Studios, so they have all these little Easter eggs, these little nods and bits referencing all the other movies that Disney has animated over the years. I mean, stuff like just like reusing animation. Disney will recycle animation or use character sketches from like the Jungle Book to inspire some other movie. And sometimes you can go online and go see videos of side by side comparisons of Disney movies that essentially uses the same animation, only a different character over it. And they do that with multiple things, which it's really kind of cool. And I recognize a lot of those, and those things kind of click in my head. And I pictured a dozen of them. And sometimes they're just a little like a character movement or the way somebody looks. And that's a lot of fun. I mean, like I said, you do kind of have to stretch for this one, but I still think it's sweet. I mean, it's a love letter to classic Disney animation, and it offers a sweet balance of traditional themes and childlike hope. I'm going to say that Wish kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk about Maestro. I talked about this several weeks ago, but it's opening in theaters this week. It will be on Netflix closer to Christmas, I think, December 20th. Let's just go ahead and play the trailer, because I actually have a decent trailer for this one. The last couple times I played a trailer for the trailer park, and then when I did the full review of this, I didn't have it was just a teaser trailer. It did not make good for the radio. This one's a little more, it gives you a little more sense of what the movie's about. Anyways, Bradley Cooper directs this examination of the life and loves of legendary composer-conductor Leonard Bernstein.
If summer doesn't sing in you, then nothing sings in you. And if nothing sings in you, then you can't make music. Something she told me.
Hello, I'm Lenny.
Hello, Felicia.
can be the first great American conductor.
There's a price for being in my brother's orbit, you know that.
Full disclosure, I had the opportunity to go out to LA and see the movie again and participate in some press conferences with some of the people who worked on the film, like the costumer and the producer and the sound designer. And they also brought in Bradley Cooper and Carey Mulligan, mainly because the last time this happened, it was during the writer's strike, and Cooper and Mulligan couldn't promote it based on SAG rules. So now they could, and they were able to talk about the movie. So it was really, really interesting to hear Cooper's passion for it. And to have him tell some of these stories. Like he talks about, there's one scene in there that's a real powerful conducting moment. And he talks about how they completely botched it the first day. And he was like, I don't know what happened. He didn't know what to do. And they kind of had to do it again the next day. And even the London Symphony, one of the percussionists from the London Symphony came up to him and was like, you know, you did not get this yesterday. Don't use that. But it was interesting to hear how he put that together and how he wore so many different hats. But it gave me a chance to see the movie again, and I got to see it in the theater. Now, the first time I saw the movie in the theater, it was at Lincoln Center at the David Geffen Theater, which has been recently remodeled, and they had a full Dolby Atmos restructuring of the sound for that theater, and it was brilliant in there. And the second time I saw this was at the Netflix private theater called the Dumb Theater, which is they've newly built. Neat little room, and it's not as big as something like the David Geffen Hall, but it also didn't have the Dolby Atmos mix. And I will say there's a difference. If you are going to go see this movie in theaters, which I suggest if you really want to see, go see it. It's worth seeing in theaters. It works on the big screen. If you get the Dolby Atmos, if you get like an IMAX or a high level, fully sound designed theater, you're going to get the most out of it. Not just for the orchestra scenes. Those sound rich and full, but you expect that. You go into a movie, you're like, yeah, the music's going to be good. But the sound design in the background, you can hear things all around you in that Atmos setting rather than just a standard stereo or what a basic theater would provide. So I can tell you through comparison of the two, there is a difference, and it's going to be even less impressive sound design on Netflix. But, you know, obviously, you know, some people choose to watch it that way. But having watched this a second time and knowing more about it, I appreciated it just as much. And the thing, not everybody's focusing on this. People are focusing on the performances. And yes, Carey Mulligan's great in it. And Bradley Cooper does a really good job as making Leti Bernstein accessible and realistic and not just an icon. But the cinematography is brilliant in this movie. Each segment of the movie is in a different era, and they change the cinematography just enough to make it work in that era. And every shot is just planned out and thought through, and it's deliberate and it's very well done. And I'm more impressed with Bradley Cooper as a director with this than I was with A Star Is Born. I think A Star Is Born was a little bit more of an easy movie. This is a bigger challenge to make interesting. And it's also not just a standard biopic. I mean, it has all those trappings, but it doesn't feel like the biopic as much as every other biopic you get during award season. So I'm just going to remind you, I think Maestro rocks. It's in theaters now or on Netflix on the 20th of December.
It rocks.
Excellent.
Coming up next on Fat Guys at the Movies, I'm going to be talking about Planes, Trains, and Automobiles and the Home Cinema Roundup featuring The Bride and the Beast. Welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's continue on with the movie reviews. I'm going to be doing a vintage one, a classic. In addition to doing Thanksgiving, the horror movie, as a selection, I wanted to talk about one of the greatest, or possibly the greatest, Thanksgiving movie of all time. Because Thanksgiving movies, I mean, look, there's a lot of horror movies and a lot of Halloween movies. They're hugely popular. There's a lot of Christmas movies. I'm not even talking about all that crap that's on Hallmark that I can't stand. That makes me want to puke until my stomach turns inside out. But I'm talking about like just classic Christmas movies. I like those, but people just kind of plow past Thanksgiving. There's a handful of them. There's a couple Thanksgiving movies. The Ref with Dennis Leary's the Thanksgiving movies. Home for the Holidays with Holly Hunter is that's I think that's directed by Jodie Foster. That's a Thanksgiving movie. Free Birds, that's that animated film about the turkeys trying to escape that. It's a Thanksgiving movie. You've got A Charlie Brown Thanksgiving, where Peppermint Patty invites herself over to Thanksgiving dinner. And people freak out because Woodstock eats turkey. And they're like, he's a cannibal. And I'm like, no, he's not. Birds are not a species. Turkeys and yellow songbirds are as different as humans and cows. They're you know, we're all mammals, they're all birds, but there's a huge, I mean, we're not cannibals because we eat cows. So, yeah, leave Woodstock alone. Let him eat some turkey, for crying out loud. I don't watch it every year, but I watch it periodically throughout the ages. One of the best Thanksgiving movies ever is Planes, Trains, and Automobiles by John Hughes. So let's talk about that one. It's available on Paramount Plus, so you can check it out yourself. A mild-mannered businessman and a gregarious salesman become unlikely companions on a doomed Thanksgiving trip home.
During holiday travel, some people get delirious. Some get delayed. And some get Del Griffin.
American Light and Fixture, Director of Sales, Shower Curtain Ring Division.
Neil Page got all three.
I was on my way home to spend a nice holiday with my family. Instead, I'm in a motel bed with a stranger.
So instead of Thanksgiving with his family, he's spending 3 days with the turkey.
This was John Hughes' breakout film that got him away from just doing teen angst movies. Because, of course, he was well known for doing, like, The Breakfast Club and 16 Candles. But this, and She's Having a Baby, which came out, I think, the same year, which is what that whole joke is with Kevin Bacon racing for a cab at the beginning of Planes, Trains, and Automobiles, because they were, you know, they had worked together. Those were the first time he was trying to do adult or grown-up comedies, not just something for kids. And this was a big hit for him. It also was at a time where Steve Martin was trying not to play the over-the-top crazy. Like early 80s, 80 to 85, he was doing stuff like The Jerk and The Man with Two Brains and his wild and crazy guy shtick. But he doesn't do that in this movie. He's the mild-mannered straight guy. And John Candy is the crazy man. And John Candy just puts in such a heartfelt performance. It's such a great performance. And what's funny is I watched this, I rewatched it last week, and then I went on this trip to LA to go see Maestro. And on my way home, I had to take the red eye, and it was a Sunday before Thanksgiving. And I had my own little Planes, Trains, and Automobiles, because I was on planes, and I was on trains, and I was in automobiles, between Ubers and the planes and multiple airports and getting on those like trams that take you. It's called the plane train in the Atlanta airport that takes you from one terminal to the next. I was dealing with the frustrations of traveling. And it wasn't even Thanksgiving yet. It was the weekend before. I can't imagine the chaos that goes on, you know, like on Wednesday before Thanksgiving, or, you know, the weekend after Thanksgiving. So I understand the frustration and the when you spend a day through airports and stuff, how much it's just you feel unpleasant. It's cramped. It's awful. But I never had to sit by Del Griffith in this one. That was the John Candy character. This movie is very funny. It's remembered for being uproariously funny, but it's not. It's a much more subtle comedy. Yes, they have the big scenes, but they also have some more smaller, intimate scenes. And they also have the comedies that's a little more, you know, subdued, where it's a little more subtle, and they have a good time. Or just the other thing that they don't do is not everything has to be this big slapstick thing. There are times where they rein the comedy in, and it's just this banter back and forth, or sometimes just dialogue back and forth. It really is a brilliantly done movie, and it is great for Thanksgiving. Now, if you really want to have some fun, I wrote an article on this. It's in my book, Movie Truth, which you can get on Amazon, or I break down how much it would have cost Neil Page, played by Steve Martin, to get home if he would have just taken a cab from New York to Chicago and compared it to how much money he spent on planes and trains and automobiles and everything else in the movie. So you can check that out if you want to go check it out. It's, like I said, you can get it on Amazon. But, I mean, this is the quintessential mix of Thanksgiving anxiety, of which there's plenty, Steve Martin and John Candy antics, and John Hughes' irreverent comedy. It was a chance for him to break out, and he totally did. And he was a better filmmaker for doing this. It totally rocks.
It rocks.
Excellent! Yay!
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That sound means it's time to roll into the home cinema roundup. I feel bad this year because one of the things I really haven't been able to indulge in because I've been so busy. Because here's the thing. We got a very early Thanksgiving. We were only 3 weeks after Halloween. And so I barely had time to enjoy the Thanksgiving time. And then I throw a business trip in the middle of that. I've had not really had a chance to watch Mystery Science Theater or Riff Tracks to fully embrace the turkeys. Because if you recall, back in the 90s and into the early 2000s, Mystery Science Theater on what it was, Comedy Central. I don't know if they ever did this on the Sci-Fi Channel, but on Comedy Central, they do a 30-hour marathon of Mystery Science Theater movies. They show 15 movies because the bad movies are turkeys, and so they watch the turkey. And so I really haven't had a chance to delve into those this year, and I feel like I've missed it. Now it's after Thanksgiving. So I wanted to, you know, at least review one of them I did. And this is from Riff Tracks. It's not Mystery Science Theater, but it's The Bride and the Beast. It's an old movie from, I think, the 50s. Ed Wood Jr. wrote this tale of a great white hunter who brings his new bride on an African hunt only to find her regressing into past animal lives.
Don't ever get that close to him again. He could have killed you.
On her wedding night, her husband's love brought the beast to raging fury. What memory in her subconscious mind evoke frenzied nightmares that could only end in disaster? See their return to the primitive jungles of Africa and the most exciting safari of modern times.
This is on rifftracks.com. It's an embedded file, so you might be able to find it on places like Shout Factory TV or Pluto TV. They have a Riff Tracks channel, or even Amazon or Tubi or something like that. It's written by Ed Wood Jr., and if you've ever seen some of his movies, it is not as good as those you remember. I mean, Plan 9 from Outer Space is a masterpiece of writing compared to the nonsensical mess of The Bride and the Beast. And what's so funny about this, it has one of my favorite things in it, which is a guy in a gorilla suit. I love guys in a gorilla suit. Every movie ever made could have been improved with a guy in a gorilla suit in it. 2001. Well, they did have guys. They weren't in gorilla suits. They were in ape suits. So, I mean, that's as good as that movie could get. But yeah, you know, Gandhi could have done better with a guy in a gorilla suit. Schindler's List would have been amazing if a guy showed up in a gorilla suit. That trope is one of the greatest things ever. And I remember I was telling my mom about that. And she was like, what was that movie that Eddie Murphy was in? And I'm like, oh, Trading Places. And she's like, yeah. I go, well, yeah, I don't think you remember what happened to the guy in the gorilla suit. I'm going to say just that much. Go watch Trading Places. It's rated R, so kiddies don't go watch it. It's not a good ending for the guy in the gorilla suit, but I love guys in gorilla suits in movies. That's the only thing that made this movie great, because the story, this guy, like, literally, he gets married. This isn't him going on a date or asking this woman to marry him. He brings his bride home, and they hear something, and he goes, oh, that's Spanky, my gorilla I have downstairs in a cage. And she didn't know about this. It's like, and the Riff Track guys were like, look, if you have a gorilla in your basement, you really should disclose that to a woman you're going to marry. But yeah, so this gorilla, of course, it falls in love with the woman and it attacks her. And then she apparently was in a gorilla in a past life and she's regressing. And so the guy's like, oh, the best thing to do is to take you on an African safari for my hunting. And then she gets kidnapped by gorillas. But of course, then there's this middle plot with a tiger that makes no sense and has nothing to do with gorillas. But that's very Ed Wood. This is a terrible movie, but it is hilarious with the Riff Tracks guys. So if you haven't had a chance to listen to some Riff Tracks, go check it out. Rifftracks.com. But you can find a bunch of them on places like Amazon, Tubi TV, Pluto TV, Shout Factory TV. I mean, the nonsensical shifting plots elements and wooden acting make for a difficult watch. But at least it features a guy in a gorilla suit. One of the greatest things in American movies. But yeah, the movie does suck.
It sucks.
And that's it for this week. I need to go. Next week I'm going to be talking about Silent Night and the Doctor Who specials that will be airing over the next 3 weeks. And until then, have a fat time at the movies.